Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Richard Cantor, the founder of the law firm Cantor Legal, which is dedicated to the full-service representation of baseball coaches, as well as the business law needs of athletes, entrepreneurs, and small business owners. He's also an adjunct professor of sports law at George Mason University. So it's good to have you here with us today, Richard.
Thanks for having me, Peter. Really excited to speak to you today.
Yeah, so this is the first episode in a series that I'm hoping to do on representation of athletes and other people in the sports world. So before we get to that, could you just give us a brief introduction so we can get to know you? Anything that you feel worth sharing?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So from Virginia originally, grew up a huge Kentucky sports fan, and so ended up going out to Kentucky to attend undergrad. While I was there, I started working for the baseball team, actually, as a manager. This summer, I worked for Boo Williams' AAU basketball team. He was my neighbor growing up, actually. He's one of the prominent AAU basketball coaches out of Hampton, Virginia. So that's kind of how I got involved in sports early on, was in undergrad, both through the baseball team at Kentucky and basketball through Boo. And knew I wanted to go to law school. You know, my plan was to go to law school and become an agent. So went to George Mason, actually, here in Arlington, Virginia, and wanted to get as much sports law experience as I could. So started doing internships, was with the Orioles, the Wizards, a basketball agency, an Olympic sports agency, just really trying to soak up as many opportunities as I could, make connections, because I knew that, you know, the classroom really wasn't going to get me where I needed to be within the sports law realm. So did that, decided kind of during law school that I actually didn't want to be a sports agent after working at multiple agencies, and wanted to pursue the front office route actually within the NBA first. So my first year out of law school, I worked in the D-League, which is now the G-League. With the Brooklyn Nets D-League team in Springfield, Massachusetts. So I went up there, didn't apply to a single law firm or anything, took the bar and just moved up to Massachusetts and worked in the D-League. It was a great experience. It was all basketball. So it was basketball operations, on the court, video work, etc. for the basketball staff and the players. Kind of realized after that year that it was going to be a long path if I wanted to stay in the front office route without being a former NBA player or kind of more of an analytics-driven person at this point. So had an opportunity to go back into the D-League. They asked me to come back, but I pretty much was said that if you can't guarantee me a job with the Nets at the end of the season, I can't be 2 years out of law school without real legal experience professionally and without a definite job in the NBA. So had an opportunity, a place I had interned at during law school, Olympic Sports Agency in D.C., asked me to come work full-time as an attorney there. And so I decided, you know, at that point that made the most sense for me. And went there, worked there for 3.5 years. It was a really good opportunity. Primarily represented Olympians, so it's all marketing deals, endorsement deals. They get a small stipend from Team USA if they're on that actual national team, but very few of them make much money there, so they're reliant on endorsements. So great opportunity to cut your teeth on contracts, as well as just building a business, recruiting clients, servicing clients, things of that nature. Also work with some NFL guys. So that's kind of my career path up until Cantor Legal. Decided, you know, I didn't want to represent athletes, like I said, but that was a great experience, and I really was intrigued by representing coaches. So thought about, you know, some of the contacts I had from Kentucky and working in with the baseball team. And I was fortunate because the head coach there actually was an athletic director now at the time in the SEC, and all three assistants became SEC head baseball coaches. And similar to football, SEC is the Premier League in baseball. And after talking to some folks, just realized there was a real need for quality representation within the baseball circuit. You know, a lot of people in basketball and football already had quality representation. Within baseball, it was primarily MLB agents or some football coaches, basketball coaches, agents who were representing baseball coaches but didn't really have a feel or a pulse for that industry in particular. So I saw a need for it. I was excited to represent coaches. It's a little bit more of a acting as an attorney rather than an agent. And so that's kind of how Cantor Legal started. And as far as the other kind of legal work I do, that is somewhat secondary to the coaches. That's the main focus of the company. Have some NBA guys, some NFL guys, some Olympians that I represent for basic business law, transactional negotiating needs. But that's more just work that comes in. So that's kind of my story, my path.
Okay. No. Yeah. That's a very unique path, I would say. and it sounds like you you knew you wanted to work in sports. You got the legal background as well. And because I think in talking with people, some with law students in particular, some people think, oh, I'll get a law degree, and then but I'm not really interested in practicing law. I want to work in the front office. I want to be the Moneyball guy or whatever. And that's mm-hmm. very exciting. But as you said, if you don't have some kind of distinguishing factor, some real analytics experience or something like that, it's just going to law school, doesn't really distinguish you too much or provide exactly what you need. And so it's a different path for everybody, but it's good to have the legal skills and the kind of more direct sports.
Absolutely. It's good to have both, and you're right. It's hard to distinguish yourself as just an attorney. The key is getting the experience and impressing the right people, so they want to hire you full-time. So if you want to work in pro sports, you really do have to make an impression on the right folks and do a really good job, and then be willing to wait it out a long time before you actually make real money, which a lot of law students and lawyers aren't comfortable doing. You can grind it out, and it might take you 8 years, though, working the MBA, making under $50,000, before you get to a point where you can make good money and do what you want within that segment or that industry. And so a lot of lawyers who have six-figure jobs sitting there aren't willing to do that. So it's certainly a life choice that people have to make.
Yeah. And then also backing up a little bit, talking about when you're in law school, you were seeking out these internships and getting them. You know, I remember when I was in law school looking at these kind of things, it was kind of like send your resume and stuff, and maybe I wasn't a spectacular candidate or whatever, but I never heard back. And so I was wondering if you have any kind of ideas as to how to have success in that kind of area where there's lots of people who want to work for, an agency or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, my advice there would be you have to cast an incredibly wide net. And, it's not earth-shattering advice. A lot of people have given it before, but it really is true. I mean, when I got the D-League job, I had applied to every single NBA and D-League team in the country. So you're talking about somebody who just graduated from law school, took the bar, didn't know I passed for another few months, obviously, in November, and I was willing to send applications and blind letters and resumes to every single NBA team and D-League team. And a lot of people aren't willing to do that. You know, they apply to one or two in their local area and don't get it, and they're surprised. You have to be willing to move. If you want to work in sports, you have to be willing to move, or you have to get incredibly lucky. And, some people do get lucky, but you can't bank on that. So you kind of have to go out there and make your own luck. And so that's how I was able to track those down. And it was also a proactive approach. A lot of the internships I got, they started off an informational interview. So I wasn't always applying to an open internship. It was constantly, I had a goal of every week I wanted to meet somebody new in the sports law world while I was in law school. And so I would just reach out to people. And, sometimes they wouldn't respond the first time, but the third time they would. So I call it being patiently persistent. You have to stay the course and continue to reach out to people, but you can't annoy them. So you have to balance that patience and that persistence to really get in, but you have to lay the groundwork. So, looking back on it, I think the only internship I got that was just a public posting was the NBA agency that I worked at in law school. All the other internships I got were I had already met somebody there through an informational interview, some sort of outreach, a common connection where I met somebody else who knew somebody there and they recommended, hey, you really should talk to this guy after I reached out. So, you really got to put in the groundwork if you want to break into sports without some of those connections. And even if you go to Harvard and you're number one in your class, a lot of those guys aren't just getting the internship blind because of their strong resume.
Okay, so it sounds like a lot of thought and a lot of work goes into that. So that's something to think about for people that are interested. The first step, I think, is figuring out what you value and what path you want to take. Because, it can be, like you said, a couple of years, a lot of years at the lower end of the spectrum before you can get kind of your dream job or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a long road. I mean, I did 6 years of unpaid internships. I was in school during those times, but still 6 years of unpaid internships. So a lot of people have done longer than that or shorter than that, and a lot of people taking that path. It's not glamorous, but if you're willing to do the work, that's what I tell. I've had dozens of interns over the years now as a practicing attorney, and I always tell them, if it's what you really want, don't have a plan B. If you want to make it happen, you will make it happen. And I've yet to see somebody who wanted to make it happen, who stuck it out for as long as they could stick it out, not succeed, not make it into getting a job in sports. Now, they'd ultimately decide to stay, and how successful they will be, we'll see. But you can make it happen. It's just how long you're willing to hold on.
Okay. Well, thanks. I think that's a lot of good advice for people. So let's move on then to talk about you and what you do. Starting your own law firm is a big step for a lot of people, and it seems like you're, again, you put a lot of thought into it. You saw something that you wanted to focus on, baseball coaches, and it targeted that. So, you know, I think a lot of people have seen sports agents, they've seen movie agents, have an idea of what that is. But could you give us a little peek into what a typical day would be like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure anybody who asks this question to will tell you there's no typical day. It's right. Kind of a joke in sports, right?
Yeah.
But it is true, even though it's cliche. And so, you know, what I really try to focus on is making sure at least every day I do something that is both helping my current clients right now today, as well as laying the groundwork to help them down the road. So I really want to make sure that I'm planning for the future each day, as well as taking care of my current needs. So, I mean, some days that is I'm on the phone all day with athletic directors, other coaches. Sometimes, I mean, 100 days a year probably I'm on the road, so I travel a lot. But being on the phone is an incredibly important part of my job, and maintaining relationships. Probably half my job is networking. So that's a really big portion, traveling to conferences, things of that nature. On the legal side of things, majority of my job for coaches is contract negotiation. And so on that end, it's primarily preparation for the negotiation. The actual conversations in the negotiation can be drawn out at times, but that doesn't take up a significant chunk of your time. It's more the research and the due diligence leading up to that, and that goes into understanding the marketplace within that conference, within that league, within that region, somebody with that level of experience as a coach. So whether that is gathering contracts, creating a database, things of that nature to really set my clients apart. That's a part of my day-to-day. When you're talking about the legal side with athletes, you know, that might be negotiating an endorsement deal. That might be giving advice on whether a business idea that a friend is presenting an athlete makes sense and whether he should enter into that business. So, and then I teach sports law at George Mason, and I'm starting a concentration there as well. So my day-to-day, it's very different, obviously. It kind of goes in cycles as far as the season. During the baseball hiring season and late spring, early summer, really through the end of summer, it's kind of an all hands on deck focus on landing guys jobs and negotiating contracts. In the fall, it's a little slower there, and you're focused on some of the other aspects of the business. But yeah, it really does change day to day.
Okay, you spoke a little bit about contract negotiation. Now that's a big part of what you do. For a lot of players in professional leagues, at least in the high levels like the NBA or the Major League Baseball and stuff, you know, there's websites dedicated to these contracts and stuff, so you can kind of compare against public information like that. For coaches, a lot of that isn't as public. So when you speak about databases, I assume that's stuff you've gathered yourself?
Yep. That's the grunt work. You got to put in the hours on your own and track down those contracts. And so I make sure I put the time in to do that for my guys. Other people might not do it as in-depth or don't think it's as much worth their time. But I make sure that I track down all those contracts that I can.
Okay. And I suppose that's why focusing on baseball as well is a value add there, because somebody who just represents coaches generally might not know the specific market or something.
Exactly. That's kind of my goal, is to be the best at one thing. You know, I think that the most successful people in life are really good at one thing. Some people are just extraordinary and they're able to be an expert at multiple things. But in general, specialization has worked for our just society in general. And so that's my goal, and that'd be another piece of advice for attorneys looking to break in or law students who want to do it on their own, is creating a niche. You know, you it's really hard to compete with the top five sports agencies who represent, you know, top 20% of agents represent 80% of athletes. Now we're talking more on the athlete side of things. So if you want to compete with those people, you have to do something better than they're doing. You're not going to have more money than them. You're not going to have more resources. You're not going to have more employees. So you have to do something at a higher level. And so my competition primarily focuses on basketball and football coaches. And so my focus on baseball makes me able to, in my mind, do the job better, as well as MLB agents focus on their representation needs sometimes on college coaches, but they don't really understand the market either because they're focused on baseball players. So I think creating that niche has been really helpful for me, and taking it out of my baseball coaching context, I think it's good advice for a lot of people looking to break in. You can usually find, you know, if there's a market for something, if no one needs it, then clearly don't go into business doing it. But if there's a market for something, I think if you focus on one thing and you become the best at it, you're going to have a lot better chance competing against people with greater resources at the large agencies.
Okay, that's really interesting. We've spoken a little bit about, you know, some of your competition or people that represent players in particular. So what do you think is are the differences and similarities between representing players versus representing coaches?
Well, certainly a lot of differences. Number one, there's a union, you know, that you have to be a certified agent if you want to represent players in any of the major sports leagues. That's not true of Olympians except for track stars. They have to have their agents be certified, but now the rest of them don't. So if you're looking at NFL, NBA, MLB, you have to be certified. So that's a big, big difference. You know, I function more as an attorney for my coaches. I don't have to be certified. So that's number one. Number two, you know, you're dealing with a totally different type of person as far as the stage they are in their life. You know, if you're an athlete coming out, you know, of college to play an NBA at 19, or a football player at 21, or a baseball player, oftentimes they're coming out of high school at 18, or college at 21, or a JUCO at 20, 19, whatever. You're not an adult yet. You know, you don't know how to function on a day-to-day basis, really. You don't know what, let alone be a millionaire. So your agent really functions as a kind of 360 service for you on the finance side, dealing with your financial person, on the on-field contract side, dealing with the organization, whatever team that is. Off the field, they're a concierge. I mean, a big part of what agents do, it's getting flowers for somebody's girlfriend, helping somebody out at 2 a.m. that needs help at 2 a.m. Their credit card, you know, bounced, and they have to get that solved, and the guy's actually on vacation in Turkey, and we still got to get it figured out. So being an agent for players, you're dealing with so many things outside of the contract because these players just really need a lot of help with the other aspects of their life. And if you're not willing to do those things, then they're going to sign with an agent who is. So being an agent in those sports is very different. And the dollars and cents is also different. If you're dealing with high-level players in those fields, if you're dealing with minimum contract players, not really much difference financially. But yeah, so those are certainly differences. It's just in the personalities. With coaches, most of my clients are 32 to 48-year-old married men with a couple kids, right? So they already have grinded it out to reach where they're at in their chosen profession, and they know how to run their personal lives. So I don't really have to get involved in the personal lives as much, which I do think is a big headache for a lot of agents on the player side. And then when I'm dealing with contracts, there's industry standards and there's things that I base, you know, my negotiating on, but there aren't requirements from a union, you know, like there are within the NFL or the MLB, where they have max percentages or these things have to be in your standard contract. There's not a standard coach's contract. Like, there is a standard representation agreement, a standard player's contract. Now, those are all negotiable, obviously, but you don't even have that starting point. So it's all very different. And also dealing with public schools is different. You know, you're negotiating with a public institution, you know, that receives state funding. You're negotiating against a MLB team. You're not dealing with those issues. So there's a level of confidentiality there that you have to deal with coaches, which is very unique. Coaches have a job that if they're looking for a new job, they don't want their current either AD to know about, or if they're an assistant, they don't want their current head coach to know about. So the level of confidentiality is, I think, far greater. With the players, a lot of that's going to be reported in the press. A lot of that's going to play out in the press strategically for both sides. And you don't have to deal with that with the coaches as much. So there are certainly some similarities, but it's a far different industry, and one I enjoy, you know, definitely more after being on the player side prior to the coaches side.
Okay, and one thing you've mentioned a couple times is how you function, you know, primarily as an attorney for the coaches that you represent. And so I just kind of, could you flesh that out a little as to what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, I mean, so what I do certainly has agent-like functions. You know, I tell guys that. I'm helping guys get jobs, right? So I kind of look at my job with coaches as threefold. Number one is helping them get opportunities through relationships that I have, whether that's through athletic directors, search firms, other coaches. It's trying to create opportunities, amplify the network they currently have to create opportunities. Once they get an opportunity for an interview, for instance, it's to maximize that opportunity. So a big part of what I do in the summer when jobs are open is interview preparation, helping guys understand how do they deal with the situation. You know, a lot of guys haven't been in an interview with an athletic director before, and so how is that going to go down? Dealing with boosters, different things that they have to deal with. So the interview preparation aspect, and then if they are lucky enough and fortunate enough to get that job and they earn that, then it's protecting them moving forward, and that's the contract. So it's, how do I open a door for them? How do I help them seize this opportunity? And how do I help them protect this opportunity via contract? And so that's, termination language is incredibly important. It's a big part of what I do, is helping these guys make sure that they keep their job. They're always going to have, you know, for cause termination clauses, but we want to limit those as much as possible so that if he loses his job, it's really something he deserves to lose his job for, and it's not something else that leads to it. So as far as the attorney aspect for them, it's really that contract negotiation helping protect them. But other things come into it. Guys have side businesses. A lot of these guys are doing speaking engagements. You know, they are running baseball camps, and they need to maybe have an LLC set up so that they can run this camp. How do I pay the coaches who are working for me under this camp? How do we set up the insurance? So a lot of the business law functions that I have for either athletes or small businesses, I also help my coaches with some of their off-the-field type work. So that's how you're functioning as their attorney, is that you're their business law attorney. You know, they sign on with Cantor Legal, I'm their lawyer. Do I have other functions in terms of helping create opportunities for them to get jobs? Absolutely. But I'm at liberty to set up my business how I want, and that's how I've chosen to set it up as their lawyer. And I do think that helps a great deal, because a lot of coaches they understand the value of having a lawyer. That's helpful. The word agent just on its own is kind of, a lot of guys are uneasy about it. You know, going and telling their AD, hey, talk to my agent. Just that sentence right there makes them uneasy and can make an AD uneasy. Some athletic directors are perfectly fine dealing with agents. Some refuse to. And so I am an attorney, and I prefer to have my business set up in that capacity. But there's no doubt there is some crossover in terms of functions of the job. And a lot of agents, you know, will set up their business. Agents who are practicing attorneys will set up their business as an LLC, an agency, because they want to skirt around certain ethical obligations as an attorney, and they don't have to deal with those maybe if they're not operating as an attorney in their mind. And so that's one of the reasons. And so I think it's important for them to know, both from the people you're negotiating with, athletic directors, as well as the coaching clients, that you are an attorney. It's kind of funny. I mean, I've seen small-time Olympic agents to MLB agents at the top five global sports agencies lie to clients and tell them that they're a certified lawyer or a barred lawyer when they never pass the bar, you know, and you see it. And guys are competing for clients, and certain clients want their guy to be an attorney, and you kind of see it sometimes. It's funny, guys who went to law school but never passed the bar, and tell guys that they're practicing attorneys. And people don't fact check it. So that's a piece of advice. If there's any athletes or coaches out there who are currently vetting agents, if they tell you that they're an attorney, make sure you check that, because that's certainly a character flaw,
yeah.
if not outright fraud,
yeah,
for someone to tell you and secure your services that they're an attorney when they're not. But that happens a lot. So there are various reasons why I chose to set it up as a law firm as opposed to just a typical Cantor Sports Management or something like that.
Okay. And you mentioned side businesses like these camps or some kind of other sponsorship or something. Is that a thing, you know, in your capacity as a lawyer, does that come about because a coach comes to you and says, hey, I have this opportunity to do this, can you help me with that? Or do you also serve as an advisor to say, well, you know, I commonly see this kind of setup, it might work for you, you know, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it goes both ways. If a guy is getting a job and I think there's some opportunities off the field that he might have, we'll discuss it, and we'll, you know, create a strategy for how to go about attaining opportunities off the field. Some guys don't care about that at all. They only want to focus on the field and winning. They don't care about anything else. But camps in particular are very common, because you have a university brand, a name, and you have a bunch of kids in the community age 8 to 18 who are interested in the instruction of a college baseball coach. So college baseball camps are a pretty big business. Some guys do more of them than others, but pretty much all of them do them in some capacity. Sometimes that's run through the university, so the university's insurance policy and the university charges and things like that, but oftentimes it's run through the coach, and they set up their own LLC, and they might pay the university for utilities and use of the field and things of that nature, but they get their own insurance, they pay their own employees, usually, you know, independent contractor. It's not a full-time job type deal. But yeah, no, I mean, those are sometimes a coach is really wants to, has a business plan, and he wants to go after this, and I'm going to advise him on doing it. Sometimes it's something that I unearth or create as far as a marketing opportunity or speaking engagement. It kind of goes both ways. But yeah, it's certainly an advisor role in all of these aspects. That's one of the biggest things that I want to do with my clients, is I want them to bring me anything related to the business side, the employment side. I want them to come to me on it, and I want to advise them on, based on what I've seen and my expertise, this is what I think you should do. Absolutely.
Okay. And then you also mentioned, you know, one difference with coaches is that there isn't a standard form contract. So do you see a great variability in these contracts and how they work?
Huge. I mean, even within the same conference, you know, you'll have some coaches' contracts be 6 pages and some be 36.
Okay.
So it's very different. I mean, usually university has developed a contract, obviously, with their attorneys. They might have a standard coaching agreement at Auburn or George Mason, right? And then each coach's individual negotiation will lead to some changes in that. Your football coaches, your basketball coaches is usually very different, but a lot of the clauses are the same. So no, it's usually the university has an agreement, they present it to me or the client, and then we start from there as far as redlining and negotiating the back and forth. But yeah, each university has very different contracts. It's kind of funny.
Okay. And typically the contracts get more complicated depending on, you know, the university, the exposure,
salary. Yeah. I mean, obviously your Power Five contracts, the baseball coaches who are making over $1 million. Yeah. Their contracts are a lot more complicated than the baseball coaches who are making $92,000 and are on an annual renewable contract as opposed to a 5-year guaranteed deal. So yeah, no, absolutely. It definitely escalates on those things.
Okay. You mentioned that you're traveling a lot, you're always on the phone. So how would you say that you interact with technology, with social media, with staying in touch with people? How does that work and what you do?
Yeah, so with technology, I'll be honest, you know, I'm not super tech savvy guy. You know, I have my iPhone, I have my MacBook, and generally speaking, those are the only tools I really need to get my job done. Where technology comes more into play for me, it's on being aware of, in the baseball sector, what technology is out there that can help my clients. So my clients have a varying level of budget, you know, it's kind of like we just discussed as far as salary. Well, that obviously goes into the budgets that your team have operating wise to get different pitching. Analytics is a big thing right now. Hitting's getting into analytics as well. You have a lot of instructors all over the country creating businesses who are saying this is the best way for athletes to develop in this area. You know, TrackMan, there's a Synergy, there's tons of things that are entering into the baseball realm, and certain coaches use more of it than others. Certain coaches believe in it more than others. Certain coaches just have the resources to attain it. So for me, technology oftentimes comes down to being aware of what's on the market that can help my clients, and less about my individual practice technology-wise. When you're starting a law firm, and I mean, I'm a sole practitioner, so I don't have maybe some of the needs that a larger law firm would have, but you have your billing software and things like that, your invoicing and things, but I don't view that as, you know, super forward-thinking technology-wise, you know what I mean? And social media is definitely an important part. You saw this summer in the baseball context, a few MLB pitchers who are players, and Trey Turner here in D.C., had some past comments on Twitter from when they were 17, 18 years old resurface. And so social media, you know, the first thing I do with my clients when I take them on is scrub their Twitter feeds, go back and see, you know, do the search to see what, if anything, was ever offensive. You know, you want to protect your clients. All those MLB players, their agents should have done that, or their agency should have done that. I mean, that's a huge problem. Josh Hader was from here. And so, guys, you know, I'm not here to throw judgment on anyone, but from a strictly business standpoint, that should be something that's done as soon as an agent signs a player. And I do that with my coaches. Obviously, the coaches, you're not having to deal with as many issues maybe because they didn't have social media when they were 17, maybe doing dumb things. But that's one aspect, is being very aware. After that, it's how do you promote your clients? So, you know, I use my Twitter handle primarily for my clients. I'm not a big social media guy in terms of personally, but I want to be able to promote my clients there because there are athletic directors on social media. There are other coaches on social media. Media itself, media is not a huge deal in college baseball. There's a couple large media entities that have pull in that field, but it's not like college football and college basketball, obviously, where the mainstream media is extremely engaged on a daily basis. But yeah, social media is helpful when dealing with those traditional media outlets too, in terms of getting guys exposure. Social media is an avenue to get that exposure. I think with certain clients, they care more about social media in a recruiting aspect way. Not many guys are using Instagram, really, in the baseball world. I think that is an untapped area for college baseball coaches to recruit on. They all use Twitter, but players and youth are on Instagram. So that's an area that I think is a little bit untapped. But certainly use social media. From a business standpoint, it's more driven towards how do I help my clients promote them. But have had conversations with clients who reached out initially via Twitter DM. So certainly use social media, but don't have it as a, you know, significant chunk of my day and hours spent.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's a lot of a lot to take in there as far as the ways you're managing different types of things. As we're getting closer to the end here, maybe I'll just ask you, is there anything that we haven't covered yet that you think would be helpful to know as far as what you're doing, what you see happening in representation of coaches right now?
Yeah, I mean, as far as representation of coaches goes, it's going to continue to evolve. I mean, you see what's going on at Maryland right now with the DJ Durkin or what happened with Urban Meyer at Ohio State. Every year you're having various coaching scandals, and so coaches have to be much more aware of protecting themselves and their contracts. And so it'll be interesting to see how the industry evolves. Search firms' involvement and coaching placements you're starting to see trickle down into Olympic sports and baseball, which had previously just been in basketball and football. So some more players coming to the market. The crossover between professional and college is starting to be mixed a little bit more in the baseball market, seeing more pro teams. Twins have hired, the Indians have hired a lot of college guys in the last few years. Mariners just interviewed a few college guys for their pitching coach job at the major league level. So there's, as far as what I'm doing, certainly going to be more crossover between the pro game and the college game in the next 5 years, I would say. But no, nothing critically important to add on the coaching front. From the aspect of law students who want to get into the industry, I do think that, you know, I teach sports law, so I deal with students. I've had a lot of interns over the years, and I find that, you know, there kind of are three traits that I've highlighted that I think make somebody really good and able to impress their employer to the point that person wants to hire them. And that's you have to be an extremely reliable person. Reliability is incredibly overlooked, and that encompasses you doing the high quality work, so I trust your work, but also how you deal with people. You know that I can trust you on a phone call, that your numbers are always right, and I can trust you in an intern context, can turn into a entry-level employment context. So be reliable, be relatable. And then the people that perform at a high level in this industry have an ability to talk to other people and make those people like them. And that's a trait that, you know, while it might come more naturally to others, you can learn and get better at. So you got to be reliable. That's most important, or else you're just going to lose your job. But if you want to be a high performer, you got to be relatable as well. And you got to be resourceful. That's one of the other things. If you're somebody who's going to have to do something like I'm doing, which isn't get on with a big agency but create a niche, you got to be resourceful, and that both means financially but also research wise what are you doing that's different, and how are you taking advantage of, or how are you creating a competitive advantage for yourself? And even if you work at the big agencies, those are the interns they're going to hire full-time. So if you're a law student who's trying to get in, save your boss money, save your boss time, do a good job, but reliable, relatable, resourceful. I really strongly believe if you do those three things and you stick it out in this industry and you wait as long as you need to wait and do as good work as you can do, that you'll get a job as a law student or as a young attorney who wants to break in. You probably have more responsibilities that prevent you from maybe taking a jump and a risk, but create relationships, set up the informational interviews, go to the happy hours, go to Sports Lawyers Association, do as much networking as you can possibly do, and then do a good job as an attorney. And eventually you might get some crossover with your clientele. But the opportunities are there. The industry is growing. The opportunities are there.
Yeah, no, and you know, I can just second everything you just said. You know, regardless of whether it's involved in sports or not, you know, those are traits that you just need to have as an attorney, as a person working in the world. You need to have somebody you can count on, and I've seen that in my career.
Those will help you in any industry. There's no doubt about it. And so you can set yourself apart by just being reliable. Every day, showing up on time is incredibly hard for a lot of people. And so if you're a law student who really wants to make it in this industry, you're probably working for somebody who's been a really hard worker for a long time, who's not going to listen to excuses that often. So that reliability angle is incredibly important. And then if you want to climb the ladder and be really good, and you want to make money, and you're motivated by those things in this industry, you got to be relatable, you got to be resourceful. So, yeah, I mean, appreciate you having me on, Peter. Any other questions or anything for me?
Yeah, no, I think that's good. Thank you for being here. I think, you know, one lesson that people can take from you in particular is that idea also of finding a inefficiency or a niche or something and filling it. Because, you know, there's a lot of people out there that want to work in sports. There's a lot of people that see these sexy jobs and stuff. And you know, sometimes you need to create something of value. And that's how you can, you know, bring value to yourself, you know. So
absolutely. Yep. 100%. So thanks a lot, and if anybody who listens to this wants to reach out, feel free. My email is richard@cantor-legal.com. More than willing to talk to students, practicing attorneys at any time.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on the Sports Law Biz Podcast. This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz Podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle handle is at Lib Montoya in both places. That's at L-I-B Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank a musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, at PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, at SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.